From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Mother's Day is one of those sugar and spice and everything nice holidays. Moms get pretty cards and flowers and breakfast in bed. Maybe. It's an occasion for sweet sentiments, rightfully so. And yet, the experience of motherhood itself, as any mom will tell you, is a lot more complicated and primal than it is sweet. Becoming a mother changes women forever, usually in ways they don't expect. In this hour, mothers who write try to put something of that experience into words, like these.
Last Mother's Day, when he was incommunicado, nothing came. 3 days later, a message in my box, a package. The mailroom closed. I went out into the lobby, banged my fist against the desk. When they gave it to me, I clutched it to my chest, sobbing like an animal. I spoke to no one, did not apologize. I didn't care about the gift. It was the note I wanted, the salt from his hand, the words.
Poet Frances Ritchie's son was serving as a soldier, a Green Beret, in Iraq, when she wrote those words. This Mother's Day, thousands of moms will be getting their cards and letters from overseas, from children who've gone to war. Frances Ritchie puts something of their experience into words in her new collection of poetry called The Warrior, a mother's story of a son at war. Ritchie herself is one of the lucky ones. Her son, Ben, is home now. When the two of them stopped by the studio recently, I asked her if she knew what she was in for when Ben first went to West Point.
Oh, no, no, no. Because when he went to West Point, we were not at war. I just saw him growing into a man, into an adult over those 4 years. And I thought he was going to be a soldier, but he went to Germany the first 2.5 years. But I really didn't think about him going to war until 9/11, and then I knew that he was going.
Ben, you can't have imagined what you were in for when you went to West Point either, I suppose.
Well, I don't think I really thought that much about it. I wanted to go to West Point. I wanted to be an officer. I wanted to serve my country. Nobody wants to go to war, but you're told on the first day that that's what you're preparing for. I mean, we were all mentally prepared for that being a definite possibility, and I have to say that our class in particular got rained on at so many important parades that we knew we would always talk about, we're destined for war. We keep getting rained on at these really important parades, so these are omens.
Well, it's sort of like that, Francis. There's a poem that you wrote about Ben's graduation from West Point that seems sort of full of premonitions, the barn swallows coming and going, mm-hmm. and argues that maybe you knew more than you thought.
It was a very strange experience because the day that Ben graduated, that his class graduated, it was like this incredibly beautiful day, and the sky was completely clear. I mean, there weren't any clouds. It was like a perfect day, and of course, it was a very celebratory day. And these birds just sort of swooped in, and they were, at first I thought they were butterflies because they were small birds and very dark, but they had red throats, and nobody seemed to notice them. And I didn't know what kind of birds they were. I had to ask people in the stands, and I finally found somebody who said, you know, those are barn swallows. No one else seemed to notice the barn swallows swoop in like a swarm of enormous black butterflies, their throats bloodied, marring the brilliance of the sky. They arrived out of nowhere, the way my son was suddenly a man. As each new lieutenant shook the secretary's hand, the swallows dipped and keened over the field, the barracks, those gray castles of learning. The dead generals bronzed on pedestals. What had drawn them to this moment, the red sash and the saber? What had drawn my son to this life? Where had it come from, his certainty of purpose? When I was my son's age, I had no faith. Now I believe in the prescience of wings. Each bird, its presentation of colors, bearing the messages we pray will never come. Looking down through borrowed binoculars into the perfect rose, I searched for his face.
Francis, war poetry isn't the only thing you write, obviously. Is writing war poetry, do you think, different from writing other kinds of poetry?
That's a really good question, and I'm glad you asked it because I never thought of these as war poems. These were really poems about my experiences waiting for my son, hoping that he would come home, trying to grapple with the fact that he might not come home. I was really speaking both to my son and to myself about what it was to be his mother, to pray that he would come home, to fear that he wouldn't come home, to want to know what he was doing, to not want to know what he was doing, to want to understand his choices because we didn't agree on some things. And I very much wanted to try to see things from his point of view as well as my own because I wanted him to come home and for us to have a good relationship when he did come home.
I'm curious about that because it is fairly well known that you have been an outspoken critic of the war in Iraq. That has to have caused some difficulties between the two of you, I would imagine, because Ben is clearly doesn't agree with you.
Right. Well, I felt very conflicted about how I felt because, you know, I've known Ben since he was from the very beginning, and he has always been a person of integrity. And there's something about him that, you know, he's just always been very committed to anything that he does, even as a little boy, you know, in school. And so I knew that he was going to Iraq because he really believed it was the right thing to do and that it was his duty and that it was a commitment for him. And it felt terrible to me to feel the way I felt about the war, which was that I felt that we should not have gone into Iraq, and yet love my son so much and know that he had integrity. And it caused me to look at how, in the past, particularly when I was younger, how I used to label people, you know, these are the good people, these are the bad people, because, you know, they don't see the way things should be and that kind of thing. I came to terms with my own tendency to be very judgmental when it came to politics. You know, I still feel that we shouldn't have gone into Iraq, but that doesn't in any way mean that I'm not proud of Ben for serving.
And for you, Ben, is it the same, only the other way around?
Yeah, basically. When my mom and I would get into these discussions, sometimes it would end badly. We would get into arguments. So we started to become more and more distant. And really, this book thankfully brought us back together and has healed our relationship a lot. And really what it's shown me, and I think it's shown both of us, is that it is okay to be, you know, I'm a conservative, my mom's a liberal. Neither one of us is, you know, far right or far left. It's okay for us to talk about those things because they're important issues, especially in an election year right now. I mean, these are things that we all need to talk about and understand what's going on and, you know, hear all the different ideas. But you don't have to leave the table angry, and you should really try, at least try to listen to the other side. I loved watching the John Adams series on HBO because to see the beginning of our country when our founding fathers disagreed on so many things, but they knew in order to survive, they had to come to some consensus. And here we are again. We have to come to some kind of consensus in order for our country to survive as the greatest country on earth. So in a very small way, I mean, in a very large way for my mom and I, but in a microcosm sort of, I feel like we set a very little example of here's what it can be like if you just – it's okay to have your own beliefs and your own thoughts and everything and to talk about them. You don't have to hate the other side.
Francis, you must be, for moms everywhere, wanting to stand up and cheer after that.
Oh, man, these have been the happiest few weeks of my life, I have to say, just to hear Ben, because we knew that we were going to get asked a lot of questions, but a lot of things that he's saying, you know – I haven't heard him say, and I know it sounds cliched, but my heart is just so filled right now with real joy to see him growing the way he has and to see that he can listen not only to me but to other people too. He always was a little ahead of me.
So, Ben, will you have to go back to Iraq?
No. As soon as I'm done with this trip here in New York, I'm going back to Colorado Springs, to Fort Carson, to basically take care of my house and all my personal stuff, and I'm getting out of the Army in July.
I'd really like to have one more poem, and I'm having trouble deciding which one. Is there one that you like that you'd read?
Well, there's a poem called The Canal, which I think makes my point. This last poem was written before the war, and it absolutely, I felt, fit in the book. And it's called The Canal. Home to carp, fallen leaves, their crisp veins melted into the murky mirror. One of the lake's long fingers licking back below an underpass into our midst. catcher of seeds and insects, feathers and clouds. The face of my boy, barely three, belly down on the worn planks of the dock, swirling a stick, stirring up something. Then the water opening, taking him, closing over his head as if nothing had happened. I looked up from my book into his absence. What is it called when the body takes over, pumps the legs to the right spot, plunges the arms down through the surface, trusting the hands to haul him up, swaddled in slime, still holding his breath, all the life he's kept from the water loosed in one fevered shriek. God can be whatever you want, a broken mirror that sees all aspects at once, the fearless child, the mother distracted, the loneliness of the water. Thank God for the circle still visible, the center discernible. Thank God for good hearing, strong legs. I carried him shivering into the house, lathered his mottled shoulders and belly, shampooed the cap of silt from his hair, little body wet in my arms, twice born.
Frances Ritchie reading from her poems about her son Ben. Her new collection is called The Warrior, A Mother's Story of a Son at War.
Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't sing, Mama's gonna buy you a diamond ring.
It's a selection from Melissa Errico's new CD of children's music, Lullabies and Wildflowers.
Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't sing, Mama's gonna buy you a diamond ring. And if that diamond ring turns to brass, Mama's gonna buy you a looking glass. And if that looking glass gets broke, Mama's gonna buy you a billy goat.
There is one nightmare that haunts every parent, the fear of one day losing your child. In 1992, the celebrated Chilean novelist Isabel Allende lost her 28-year-old daughter Paula to an unexpected acute illness. For a long time, Allende thought she would never write again. Eventually, she channeled her grief into a memoir called simply Paula. It's a book Allende says was written with tears. Now, 16 years after Paula's death, Allende has written another memoir, The Sum of Our Days. It's the story of how her family helped Allende recover from her daughter's death. It's a portrait of a group of eccentric, funny, strong-minded people, some related, some not. Allende calls them her tribe, and she told Anne Strainchamps that living in an extended family this way is a Chilean tradition.
We live in a very tribal way. Families are extended. When we introduce ourselves, we usually say both family names, the father and the mother, so that the other person will know who we are. We immediately know if we are related or not. So there is a sense of family and extended family that is really important. I grew up like that.
And there's also the expectation that children, rather than growing up and moving away, will stay connected to the family, stay with their parents.
They do. When you marry, both families are joined in a way, but you don't move away. Usually the children stay at home until they marry, if possible. The idea is that you stay with your family forever.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it sounds very strange in the United States, and it sounds also a little exaggerated in Chile because things have changed, especially in Santiago. But when I moved to the United States in 87, my husband had no family. His father died when he was very young. He was practically an orphan when he was six. He grew up with no family. Then he married, had divorces, two divorces. His children were addicts. There was no family life of any kind. The children didn't know their uncles or aunts or grandparents. So I couldn't understand how it worked. And then I decided that I needed to bring my children to the United States and put together first a little family, and then I needed more people. So I kept adding and adding, and now we have a tribe.
Has your family generally appreciated your wanting to have them close, or have there been times when they've, I don't know, tried to adopt a more American style of family and wanted to push you away, talked about boundaries?
I have never asked them. So I don't know. Probably they hate me, but but that's the way it is. I know that there is a boundary issue. When my son married an American woman, of course she wasn't used to have her mother-in-law walking into the house with her own key at midnight. And I had to learn my boundaries and be more respectful. And now we have sort of an agreement that we are very close, but we are not in each other's face. But we live all within a sort of emotional compound. We all live in the same neighborhood. The women all work together. We share clothes, we share lives, we share kids, food, everything.
You know, you've written in this book and in a previous book about the tragic and unexpected death of your daughter, Paula. And in fact, this book takes the form as of a sort of letter to Paula, catching her up on family events. Was this partly a way of keeping her close to you?
She's very close, not only to me, to all of us. She's a huge presence. After I wrote that book, Paula, I got hundreds, thousands of letters from readers all over the world. And I've created a foundation to honor my daughter and the work she was doing when she was alive. So I get letters all the time that mention her, letters about her. So I feel that she's my companion. I miss her. I wish I could talk on the phone with her or see her. But I know she's with me in my memory, at least.
As the years went by after her death, after a year or two or three went by, how did your grief evolve?
At the beginning, the grief was overwhelming and it used all the space and there was no space, time, or energy for anything else. Writing the book gave limits to the grief. I could name things and say, this is what happened. My daughter died. She died because of this or that. And so by putting boundaries to the grief, I could deal with it much better. And then as time went by, I think that I feel the sadness like a sediment in the bottom of my heart. But it's a very fertile soil. Everything grows there, you know. It's not bad. I don't want to get rid of it.
You said that she's still a big part of your life, you know, in the form of memory and people who write to you about her. Does she still feel present to you in other ways as well?
I see signs here and there of her, but I don't see ghosts. I do believe that there is spirit and that life is very mysterious, but I'm not looking for ghosts.
Do you feel like you still speak to her?
Yes, all the time. I find myself in the car sometimes talking aloud to her. I dream. I have very vivid dreams of her, sometimes so vivid that I wake up and I feel that she's sitting next to me on the bed. And then I turn on the light and, of course, she's not there. Very present, very, very present.
You know, the memoir, I mean, you write about loss, this loss and other losses. You also write about some new beginnings. And not long after you lost Paula, your life presented you with another series of terrible circumstances, but which ultimately led to the birth of a very special granddaughter or step-granddaughter.
Yes, my husband, Willie, has three biological children, all addicts. And his daughter died or disappeared very young, and she left a premature newborn baby, Sabrina, who, of course, was very weak when she was born and very ill because of the drug addiction of the mother she was using during the pregnancy. And this girl is now going to be 15. She's a smart cookie. She's healthy and she's doing great. So out of all that grief and all that losses and struggle, at least we have this wonderful granddaughter.
You have some wonderful stories from the time of around Sabrina's birth. I think you wrote that the nurse in the preemie nursery,
mm-hmm.
who'd cared for hundreds of babies, insisted to you that Sabrina was an old soul, that there was something special about her. Do you believe that?
Yes, I believe that Sabrina is very special. She was born very, very small because of all the problems she had in the pregnancy, but also because she was very premature. But with open, her eyes were open, dark, large, beautiful eyes. And she would stare at you, and there was no way that you could escape that gaze. And Sabrina, who was destined to end up in a foster home somewhere, or maybe most probably die because she was so ill, ended up being adopted by two extraordinary women. One of them, a Buddhist nun, and the other mother, it's a doctor, pediatrician. So she has been very well taken care of from the very beginning. She couldn't have chosen better people.
Could you tell how that came about?
Yeah, when Sabrina was born, and I was on a book tour, and when I came back, already Sabrina had been taken away from the mother, and she was going to be placed in a foster home as soon as they could take her out of the hospital. And I was horrified at the idea that this baby would end up in some unknown hands. And I met with my little prayer group. We are six women that we meet regularly to meditate and to help each other, to witness each other's lives, a circle of women. By the way, I think that all women should have a circle of women, a circle of friends. And so we were together there having a cup of tea, and I mentioned I told them what had happened and how sick Sabrina was, and I said, this baby needs two mothers. And one of my friends said, two mothers? Wait a minute, I think I know two mothers. We were in a restaurant. She used the restaurant phone and called the Zen Center and talked to Fu, who was at the time the director of the center, a Buddhist nun. And she had a partner. They had been together for 8 years, and they were thinking of adopting. So she told her on the phone the conditions of the baby. And she said, we will call you back in 10 minutes. 10 minutes to decide something like that. In 8 minutes, they called back, and they said they wanted to see the baby. I took them to the hospital, and when they held the baby, and Sabrina looked at them in the eye, that was it. They said, this is the girl that we've been waiting for all our lives.
Oh. You know, one of the things that your readers have always treasured about your writing is, I guess, the way you describe life as potent with magic and mystery. In real life, in your real waking life, do dreams and portents and visions come up for you too?
Yes. And there are many things that are inexplicable. They are not miracles. There's nothing fantastic about any of this, but the coincidences are strange. And some signs are strange, and most people go through life without noticing any of that. But I'm a writer. I'm quiet and alone most of the time. I see the connections. I see the signs. I'm looking for the mystery. So my life is enriched by all that.
Part of it strikes me as trying to be sensitive to or to look for the beauty in life, because surely beauty is a kind of meaning. So because you're looking for it, you see it.
Yeah, you see the beauty, and you see a sort of poetic meaning to things. Not everything is cause and effect. Not everything is logic and rational. There is a lot that is totally unexplainable and wonderful. And the more I am with babies, with kids, with animals, in nature, with old people, the more I see that.
Do you believe in life after death or in rebirth?
I don't think I will. I hope I will not come back as a dog or as another person. But I do believe in the soul. I think that after we die, not everything dies. That there is a spiritual element that is not destroyed. And I think that is present in everything, in trees, in plants, in rocks, in everything that exists. And there is a sort of ocean of spirituality and consciousness, and we are all just drops of that ocean, and we will go back to that. So I don't think I will find my daughter in the form that I knew her. But when I become just spirit as she is now, we will be together. Maybe without identifying each other, but we will be both in the same ocean.
Isabel Allende is the author of 8 novels, 4 memoirs, and a trilogy of children's novels. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps about her latest memoir called The Sum of Our Days. Still to come, a young novelist takes a close look at how women juggle life with small children and a career. And the Penderwicks are back. 4 zany sisters, 1 clueless dad, and their irrepressible dog, Hound. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. For many women, motherhood is something to be longed for. Pregnancy, a condition to be eagerly anticipated. But as commentator Amanda Henry knows, the road to motherhood can be unexpectedly rocky.
The day I started high school, in a new town, I was wearing an unusual accessory. A big, red, Rudolph-esque cold sore on my upper lip. There's nothing like the suggestion of a contagious disease to win friends and influence people. Though had my classmates been bold enough to ask, I could have explained that I always get disfiguring facial blisters at such inopportune moments. It's a great antidote to vanity. Someday I plan to gather those precious recollections into a chapter for my hypothetical self-help book, should a market ever develop for depressing tales of self-improvement through humiliation. Other entries in this gloomy tome will include Why Being Bad at Sports Isn't So Bad and Infertility, a Future Parent's Best Friend. Can you see Oprah getting on board? I don't mean to sound glib because I have yet to find much humor in the experience of wanting children and not being able to conceive. Or, as in my case, waiting for many years and then finally, unexpectedly expecting, at Christmas no less, only to discover at the first ultrasound that it's a strange kind of phantom pregnancy in which the process begins but a baby never develops inside your expanding womb. It's a terrible thing to look for that flickering blob of life, the one you've spied floating in black and white on your friend's refrigerators, and see only an empty screen. But maybe it was worse the way I lost my second pregnancy, suddenly, almost a year to the day later. No one really expects to be in a pair of plane crashes, or shark attacks, or house fires. Surviving one is supposed to provide cosmic immunity. There are so many shards of memory I could share with you. The words, the waiting rooms, maladroit attempts at comfort. Here, hold my baby. As my Catholic mind searched for meaning in it all, the best I could come up with was empathy. A nice-sounding word that is as unpleasant in the acquisition as the so-called gift of humility. But at least I can now say to others, I hear you. I have been to that place, or at least a neighboring town. It's a sentiment that meant a great deal to me, when so many had the grace to share their own sorrows. There was another wrinkle to this unpregnant pause. One day I found myself staring at 2 pink lines again. I had been sure it was a dread disease, and after sweating out the weeks until the doctor's appointment in a conflagration of dread, cynicism, and secret hope, it turned out to be a real baby, little heart thumping away. As much as I felt entitled to the good news this time around, the sense of disbelief was familiar. To lose a baby is too much to grasp. To have a baby is just as unfathomable. On some level, the miscarriage is registered as my fault, whether by an error of biology or age, karma or jogging. Yet for the pregnancy, I couldn't take credit. It was a mystifying bit of serendipity, outside my conscious control. There's something liberating about not being in charge. I was very calm during my pregnancy, though not because I didn't believe anything bad could happen. On the contrary, I knew that it might, but there was nothing I could do. Dread is not a suit of armor, and anxiety never softens the blow. The day after my big, loud, scowling baby girl was born, at Christmas, of course, her pediatrician diagnosed a slight heart murmur. It may have been the hormones talking, but I just looked at his scribbled ballpoint sketch and thought, could be. But did you see the jiu-jitsu she used on those nurses who tried to give her an EKG? I think she's going to be okay. Like all parents, I'm still haunted by wisps of fear for my bonny little daughter. Yet I try to take the days as they come, instead of as they might possibly be in some horribly gothic alternate future. That will be the coda to my chapter on parenting. Don't even pretend to be ready for the worst. The stress will give you cold sores.
Commentator Amanda Henry. You know, considering how universal an experience parenthood is, it's astonishing how few birth scenes there are in novels. I mean, think about it. How many famous female characters can you name who go through labor and delivery? Novelist Rachel Paston told Steve Paulson that's one reason she began her new novel with a childbirth scene. The book is called Lady of the Snakes. Its protagonist is Jane Levitsky, a young professor of 19th century Russian literature, whom we first encounter giving birth.
During Jane's miserable 20-hour labor, she thought a lot about Masha Karkova, who had died in childbirth in 1884, along with the baby she was carrying. Jane's pain was in her back, and she crouched moaning on the rug in their tiny living room, waiting for Billy to come and get her. And later she screamed, staggering up and down the hospital room with its pastel prints and floral curtains, like a decent hotel, only with cupboards that opened to reveal sterile pads and stainless steel. Dying seemed a likely outcome, much likelier than producing a child. As she cried Billy's name, she wondered if Masha had cried out for Grigori, and if so, what he had done. Not pressed a tennis ball into the small of her back the way Billy was doing, the way they'd been taught in childbirth class. Not that it helped.
By the end of this scene, the baby is born, but Jane, the mother, is feeling so battered, so out of it, that she finds herself again thinking about a childbirth scene in a 19th century Russian novel she's been studying, and she suddenly realizes she's missed the first moments of her own child's life. And it's a wonderful opening passage because it really sets up the tension that runs throughout this novel, how Jane struggles to be both a mother and a literary scholar. What made you take on this subject?
When I had my first child and had decided that I was going to try to keep working on my writing and also spend a fair amount of time doing the mom thing, being with her, I knew it would be hard. I knew it would be challenging, but I did not realize how hard it was going to be. I was shocked by how hard it was to figure out what I wanted to do, to spend long days with an infant, to try to find any time for my own work, to not feel guilty about wanting time for my own work. And I did what I always do, which is I looked around for books, for novels that would reflect my life experience back to me and say, yes, somebody else has experienced this and this is what it's like. And I didn't find any.
That's so interesting because I tend to think of there being so much that's been written about this basic dilemma. I mean, sort of the so-called mommy wars, you know, women
that's right.
trying to reconcile family with work. But you're saying 12 years ago or so, there weren't many things written about this?
14 years ago. Yeah, that's right. In the mid-90s, I think a lot of it hadn't got down on paper yet. People were maybe talking about it. Maybe people were writing about it in the newspaper, but not the complex texture of a novel. And when I showed early drafts of this novel to women, mother friends of mine, they said, why would you want to read something that, you know, you already experienced and got through and now it's behind you?
Tell me something about that, about sort of some of the fine points of what you were trying to get across in that whole experience.
I think one of the things that's really hard is closing the door on one self and opening it to the other self. So when you're at work, being at work, and when you're with your family, being with your family. I found that an immense challenge for years. I mean, I was working in the house too, so I didn't have like a commute or even a walk to get me from one place to the other. It was like the baby was downstairs with the babysitter and then the door opened and then there was the baby. And it was hard to be like, okay, that door is closed. Now I'm this version of myself. And that interested me. I think also just what it is like to spend whole days with people who don't speak back to you, for somebody who's very verbal, is a particular kind of challenge.
Did you feel like there were times when you were just kind of losing your mind? I mean, spending so much time with a baby or a very young child?
Yeah, I definitely felt that I was losing my mind. Although both my daughters were much desired and longed for, and I was happier in a basic way once they were born than before they were born. But the hours were often very difficult to get through. And I have had and have a wonderful, terrific, active husband, father to the kids. But even though I think we both thought going in we were doing things 50-50, I think 50-50 turns out to be a lot harder, even for people with very good intentions, than they suspect. You know, 50-50 goes to 70-30 and sort of squinches back and forth.
Well, in your novel, the marriage between Jane and her husband, Billy, nearly falls apart as they're trying to deal with all of this. I mean, the stress of parenting, her new academic job, he's in law school, just starting out. And at one point, Jane is away out of town, and she's doing research. Their girl gets sick, and Billy is left to deal with the whole ordeal in the hospital. And when Jane gets back, she's feeling guilty. Billy is resentful. And you have a scene that gets at some of this tension. Could you read that?
Yeah. That night, after putting Maisie to bed, Jane went downstairs where Billy was watching the Bulls game. She sat beside him on the old brown sofa. "What's the score?" she asked. "Bulls up by 2. "Close game." Billy said nothing. The light from the television flickered across his face, so she could see only intermittently how tense and unhappy he looked. "Want a beer?" Jane asked. Billy glanced over at her, surprised. "Okay," he said, "sure." Jane got up, went into the kitchen, came back with an open beer. She handed it to Billy. "Thanks," Billy said. "You're welcome." "You're not having one?" "No." Jane pulled her legs up under her, turned her face to the television. There was a pause. Jane tried to follow the game. Then Billy said, "Since when are you that kind of wife?" Jane looked at him. He looked like someone she used to know a long time ago. "What kind of wife?" she asked. "The kind who gets up to get her husband a beer." "I'm the same kind of wife I've always been," she said. "What kind do you want?" The game went to commercial. Billy shook his head. "No," he said, "you're different." "How exactly?" Jane asked. She was curious. Billy shrugged stiffly. "I think you used to be happier before," he said. "Before," Jane thought. "Before what? Before Maisie was born? Before they were married? Before they moved to Madison and she had a job and he didn't?"
Oh, that's so wonderful. I mean, sort of how you captured the coldness that has crept into their marriage and how they're really not able to talk about it.
Yeah, and I think it's a really hard thing to talk about. And I feel bad for them because I keep thinking, if you just hold on, you know, you'll get through it. It will be better next year, you know, it'll be better the year after that. But in the middle of it, it's hard to see that. It's hard to know that.
Now, there's another plot strand in your novel by way of contrast, the story of a 19th century woman, Masha Karkova, the wife of the Russian novelist that Jane is studying. This is a woman who had none of the opportunities that modern women like Jane have. I'm wondering if you based this story on the real lives of 19th century women you have read about.
Well, I did start out by reading about Tolstoy and his wife, Sophie Tolstoy. So they were kind of where I started. And I guess the thing about Sophie Tolstoy that always strikes me, besides the fact that she had, I think, 13 children and 7 or 8 miscarriages, and that her husband insisted that she give birth to them on this uncomfortable red leather couch that had been in his family that he felt all of his children should be born on, was that she would copy out his manuscripts at night when he was done working on them so that he would have fresh copies to look at in the morning. And I do have Masha do that for Grigori in my book. I write longhand, and I would so love to have somebody type that stuff into the computer every night so I could have nice fresh copy in the morning. So the fact that after working all day and supervising the education of the children and sewing the clothes, and it's true that she had servants, but giving orders to the servants and supervising them and dealing with a million comings and goings, that after dinner, when everybody else was done doing stuff, she would then sit down to make these fair copies, really, I think, is remarkable.
You'd like to have a wife, too.
Yeah. Or at least better voice recognition software.
Right. Yes. A lot of women talk about how their lives play out in stages. There's often sort of the early career burst. And then there's maybe the intense motherhood stage where career becomes secondary. And then there's the reemergence of the career when the kids get a bit older. Has it played out for you that way?
I don't think my kids are quite yet at the bit older stage. I guess they're a bit older. I have a child going to high school and one going into middle school, and I think, oh my God, they're going to be gone any moment, you know? So how much time I'll have to work when they're gone, and what will I do without them when they're gone? And so it's sort of the same as it was all the way through, wanting everything from both sides.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the other side of it, too. I mean, we're talking about all of this as if parenting is just something that you have to endure to get through so that you can free yourself to write. But of course, that's only part of the equation here.
Yes, because, well, for me, certainly life was sad and empty without those children in it, making a mess and not giving me any time to do anything and wanting a million things. So for me, better this way than the other way. And I guess I do feel like I wanted this to be ultimately an optimistic book and say, we need to keep trying to make it possible to have lives as full as possible, both for women and for men, and to have our families be our anchors that we can go out from. When I was trying to think what should happen to Jane in the end, I thought what I really want her to do is to keep trying to get it right and to make it work for her, make this life work for her.
Rachel Paston talking with Steve Paulson about her novel Lady of the Snakes. By the way, for more information about anything you've heard this hour, or to send questions or comments, check our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When Jean Birdsall began writing for the very first time at age 41, she never imagined that her first novel, The Penderwicks, a summer tale of four sisters, two rabbits, and a very interesting boy, would become an instant classic. The book won the 2005 National Book Award. Now, just in time for another summer, the Penderwicks are back. Four zany sisters, their widowed father, and their goofy dog, Hound, are ready for more adventures in The Penderwicks on Gardam Street. There's just one thing missing in this family. A mom. Anne Strainchamps is a big fan of the Penderwick books, and she wondered whether they grew out of the author's own memories of a happy childhood.
No, my childhood wasn't this idyllic. I had one older sister who didn't like me at all. But I read books all the time about families like this, and I think I internalized that and made them my family. My imaginary families that I could live with, like the All of a Kind family, Sidney Taylor's books, and the Bastable family in E. Nesbitt books, and all of Edward Eger's families. It seemed like so much fun. So when I went to write a children's book, I was more interested in writing about one of those fun families that children could relate to rather than my own not-so-fun family. I thought, why relive that?
After changing out of her soccer uniform, Jane gathered some supplies, an apple, a pen, and a blue notebook, and headed up Gardam Street. She was going to Quigley Woods, her favorite place in the whole world. That day, she headed to what she called her Enchanted Rock. Though she was 10, all certainty of magic had not yet been squashed out of her, and she believed that if there was any at all in Massachusetts, it would be stored in that rock. Her sisters could know none of this. Rosalind was too old for magic adventures, Batty too young, and Skye had given up on magic the day she discovered long division.
Yeah, critics, the one word I see coming up a lot in describing your books is the word nostalgic, by which I think critics mean that you write about a kind of innocent childhood world. And, mm-hmm. you know, in that sense, your books really go against a lot of the current trends in children's literature. You know, most of the other books that we see, these days for kids tend to, kids are either saving the world from the forces of evil or they're coping with, you know, really appalling problem, drug abuse, teen pregnancy, alcoholic, dysfunctional families. Did you set out deliberately to buck both those trends?
It wasn't that I decided to buck the trends as much as I wanted to write the kind of book I wanted to write, and I wasn't interested in writing about those things. Once again, it goes back to my childhood. I knew the kind of books that gave me comfort, and so I wanted to give that kind of comfort to other children. There are children that need the edgy books, too. I certainly think there's a really important reason for them to be there. Children respond to life and difficulties in different ways. Some need validation that they're not the only one going through hard things, and those edgy books can help them. And some need escape from difficulties, and some kids have difficult parts of their lives and also lovely parts of their lives, and they can have the lovely part validated too.
One of the things I love about your stories is your descriptions of the ways the sisters interact with each other. You know, it's so accurate. They both love each other very, very much, and they also bug each other to death. And you know, and the way both those feelings get expressed is often funny. How did you know so much about what it's like to be a girl growing up in a big family like that?
I don't know. That's a really good question. Probably partly from the books I read, and it could also be that I grew up in a neighborhood, a wonderful neighborhood, one of those neighborhoods that was created out of nothing after World War II, and tiny houses built all over farmland and then full of young men back from the war, and they all had millions of children. It was one of those neighborhoods where in the summer when the sun went down, you started to hear the mothers calling from all over the neighborhood, Michael, Joseph, Linda. And then the softball game would break up and everyone would scatter. Mm-hmm. You know, and everybody says, oh, it's so idyllic. That's what the 50s were like. But of course, a lot of those fathers were drinking too. So there were good parts and bad parts.
And even in very close families, like the one you write about, everything is not always idyllic. Kids can feel misunderstood, or they can ache for privacy and solitude. Those tensions come out in the family you write about some, don't they?
Right. Things that are frightening for children that aren't in their control. And of course, in the second book, Mr. Penderwick is sort of tricked into starting to date. And these girls have created with their father a solid family that the balance works for the 4 years since their mother has died, though they miss her very terribly. And because they still miss her very terribly and they don't want any kind of change. Change is frightening to children. So that's what the second book is about, is their ridiculously insane ways of trying to control this.
Rosalind glared defiantly at the others, daring them to protest. So I've been trying to come up with a way to stop this dating nonsense. I'd hoped to have a plan before we got here, and I've tried and tried, but I haven't come up with anything except a name. The Save Daddy Plan. How about murder? Said Skye. As quickly as Aunt Claire comes up with blind dates, we kill them off. Batty looked fascinated.
How would we do it?
Please, please stick to the point, everyone. We have to help Daddy. And we have to make sure we don't end up with a...
Stepmother, finished Skye.
And I am sticking to the point. But if you don't like murder, how about this? We can't actually stop the dating altogether. So why don't we find 3 more dates for Daddy that he'll hate as much as Ms. Muntz? He won't date any of them more than once, and the whole experience will be so horrible that he'll never date again. And we'll never end up with a stepmother. Brilliant, yes?
They start a Save Daddy Club.
The Save Daddy Club, which is a little projection, because of course they're trying to save themselves. But
they're trying to save him from falling into the clutches of the wrong kind of wife?
Right, because they don't want the wrong kind of stepmother. They don't want a stepmother at all.
Do you think writing the books helped you come to terms with your own childhood? I mean, did you write them partly to give yourself the childhood that you wanted but didn't quite have?
Well, maybe I was doing that. I think it was more to put out in the world that that childhood is really what children deserve. I think that was more what I was interested in. But I wasn't that much on a mission. I really just wanted to have fun, and I wanted to write books that made me laugh and didn't bore me. The way I describe it is I'll work and work and work on a scene and a sense of feeling, and then all of a sudden the girls start talking on their own. They just crack me up, and there's so much joy it doesn't even seem like me anymore. So I think that's why I decided to write that kind of a book.
Jean Birdsall is the author of The Penderwicks and its sequel, The Penderwicks on Garden Street. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. And we'll close the hour with one more song from Melissa Errico's new CD, Lullabies and Wildflowers.
You belong among the wildflowers. You belong in a boat out at sea. Sail away, kill off the hours. You belong somewhere you feel free. Run away, find you a lover. Go away somewhere all bright and new. I have seen no other who compares with you. You belong among the wildflowers. You belong in a boat out at sea. You belong with a love on your arm. You belong somewhere you feel free.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to purchase a copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Mother Stories, number 511A. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Anne Strainchamps, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. We always like to know what you think of our programs. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.